During his first term in office, President Widodo promised to return Indonesia to its maritime roots and establish the country as a maritime power. Some may wonder, though, how did the world's largest archipelagic state lose its maritime roots to begin with? Widodo is now in his second term, and he appears to have abandoned his maritime vision. What does this mean for Indonesia, and what does it mean for the region? This comes at a time where we continue to see encroachment by Chinese vessels into Indonesian waters, and even challenging Indonesian authorities.
We are carrying out the patrol in the sea realm under the jurisdiction of the People's Republic of China.
Are these just random fishing vessels wandering into Indonesian territory? Or is this a strategic move by Beijing as part of a wider long-term goal? I discuss these important maritime issues, territorial disputes with China, how Widodo's plan to move the nation's capital might impact the armed forces, and much more with Dr. Evan Laksmana, a political scientist and senior researcher at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, here in Jakarta. He's one of the most informed when it comes to the Indonesian military and security. Dr. Evan, thank you for joining us today in the studio.
Thank you.
If I may, Pak, start with maritime.
Sure.
In the run-up to the 2014 election, President Widodo, or candidate Widodo at the time, campaigned heavily on returning Indonesia to its maritime roots.
Kita telah terlalu lama memunggungi laut, memunggungi samudra, dan memunggungi selat dan teluk. Ini saatnya.
And bring back Indonesia's maritime expertise and capabilities. There was a lot of hype during the campaign and into his, you know, first year or so on this policy. And the policy was giving sort of a fancy name. It was the Global Maritime Fulcrum, or GMF. On that point, though, I want to get into this a little bit later, but what comes to mind is, you know, how did Indonesia deviate from its maritime roots and being its the world's largest archipelago? But I think that's fascinating because we're talking about how a president in 2014 is pushing Indonesia to go back to its maritime roots. And it's sort of, you know, it's a world's largest archipelago. So it's kind of sort of a contradiction there. The GMF was intended to be a grand vision and strategy, included both foreign and domestic policy elements. It was based on 7 pillars: maritime defense, security, law enforcement, safety at sea, maritime and human resources, economy, infrastructure, maritime culture, and among many others. The president even established a coordinating ministry for maritime affairs. And I think that you said once that this is not the first time that was happened. It was 1955, correct? There was a coordinating ministry for maritime back then?
It wasn't called the coordinating ministry. I think there was a maritime council type situation. This was around the time when we started thinking about UNCLOS and all that. But yeah, I think going back to your first point about the contradictions in us trying to come back to this maritime roots, we can talk about that more later on, but I think the short answer is because the arrival of authoritarian rule under Suharto, I think, domesticated everything else.
So internal
right,
focus?
It's all about internal security. And to be fair, historically, that's been the case when it comes to military operations from 1945 up until the end of the Aceh War in 2005. The majority of military operations, about 70%, have always been internal, whether it's insurgencies, terrorism, riots, you name it. So the majority have always been internal security. So from that standpoint, it's a push and pull between the requirements of the day-to-day operations on the military and security side versus what is, you know, an ideal long-term geostrategic or geopolitical outlook, which is maritime-based. But again, the priorities of the new order sort of took over everything else. And even the doctrine of the Navy was in some ways domesticated, that the naval doctrine included elements about law enforcement, for example, about maritime culture potential. These are efforts to get the Navy to engage with local communities and local businesses and local political actors back in the New Order days. And that has left a legacy where I think the Navy and to some extent the Air Force is still trying to get out of.
Mm-hmm. And heavy focus on the Army.
Right, right. And I think this is an ongoing process. We're not there yet. But I think it's an ongoing process.
Untuk mengembalikan Indonesia sebagai negara maritim samudra.
And this is why I think with Jokowi's platform, I think it should be noted that the GMF idea, it was not a document that was sort of well researched and well developed over the years. It was essentially a campaign platform. In fact, if I remember correctly, it was decided over breakfast a few weeks before the first presidential debate with Prabowo. And, you know, it made sense. Jokowi was essentially a local official who rose through the ranks, while Prabowo was a Jakarta player. He had a military background. So having more of a geostrategic outlook really distinguishes Jokowi from Prabowo, which at that point, given his military background, it was surprising that he didn't have a much larger geopolitical vision for Indonesia, and he just expect us to believe that I'm a military guy, trust me. Yeah. Well, this is a campaign. We need more than trust, right? And then after Jokowi was elected, I think there was a moment, maybe the first 1 or 2 years, where I think there was a genuine drive and energy across the ministries that this is the first time we have a big vision, and we feel like it's about time we figure out stuff like, you know, how much of our GDP comes from the maritime industry? How do we ensure that the projection continues to increase on the fishery sector? How do we link the protection of the fishery sector with Coast Guard development, with maritime development? So for the first 1 or 2 years, I think these kinds of conversations are normal. And if you go to all kinds of seminars from the government, you will see their ability of the bureaucracy, I mean, to sort of attach a global maritime fulcrum to every event, improving finance accountability to strengthen global maritime fulcrum, you know. So they would like attach these terms to everything they do. But that's, you know, it's partially bureaucratic, but it's also partially a genuine sense of optimism, I think, across the bureaucracy. But then I think a lot of things happen along the way. Jokowi had other priorities. I think after the first 1 or 2 years, I don't think he woke up every morning thinking, how am I going to improve global maritime fulcrum today? I think because he didn't personally, I think, handheld a lot of these processes and all that, I think what you have is essentially different agencies interpreting what does it mean to implement the global maritime fulcrum in their own way. And this is where there's a huge decline in terms of the optimism. Yeah. There's a huge decline in terms of the overall outlook. And even the national sea policy that was issued through a presidential regulation in 2017 could not get passed. Mm-hmm. So I think its rise and fall was pretty dramatic and quick, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, despite all the hype and attention to it, I think it fell far short than expectations. And I think it's important to remember that I think around a little over 80% of Indonesian territory is ocean. So it'd be a very important policy to have. And correct me if I'm wrong, but to this point, Indonesia doesn't have a properly functioning
Coast Guard? Well, it's not that we don't have a Coast Guard. We have multiple versions of a Coast Guard. And it starts from one sort of big structural problem, which is there is an overlapping in terms of laws and regulations that around the maritime sector that essentially it gives about 12 different agencies participation and role in maritime governance.
Which can be very confusing who's coordinating and who's leading it.
And within that 12, about 5 or 6 actually have patrolling assets, because the 12 includes like customs and enforcement all the way down to Bakamla, which is the maritime security agency, and now sort of the official version of our Coast Guard. Now, within the 5 or 6 agencies, you have the Marine Police, you have the Department of Transportation's Sea and Coast Guard, you have Bakamla, you have the Navy, which still keeps its law enforcement role. So among these different agencies, and with Jokowi's first term, you have the Task Force 115 that was created by Susi.
The former Minister of Fisheries.
Right, correct. So with these competing bureaucratic actors, it's essentially you take your turns type of operations.
Yeah, yep. So you're competing for resources, budget.
You're competing for resources, budget, and even legitimacy. Who is the real Coast Guard? Because if you look at the number of international MOUs, for example, about Kamala, because technically they're directly under the president. They've signed quite a bit, I think about 12 in the last few years, which makes them sort of the international representation of our Coast Guard. And this is not without its challenges, because the Department of Transportation and the Fisheries Ministry all disagree. The Fisheries Ministries believe, no, it's us who has the Coast Guard, right? So it's essentially, if you want to make it simple, okay, from Monday to Tuesday, from 5 to 6, it's this agency. From 7 to 12, it's that agency. Essentially, it's like that, because there's no single agency that can control the waters full on 24/7. None of them, including the Navy. There's issues of patrol assets and personnel, but also fuel and facilities, especially if you talk about the outer islands, in which there isn't always a steady supply of fuel and all that. So we have a Coast Guard, depends on who you talk to. If you talk to the Fisheries Ministry, they would say, we are the Coast Guard. If you talk to Bakamla, no, we are the Coast Guard. So it's not that we don't have one, it's just we have more than one.
Mengembalikan Indonesia sebagai negara maritim.
The president established the Maritime Security Agency, I think, in 2014 on paper, but implementing that until now has been a challenge. And I think right now, under, I think, the omnibus law bill, I think there's a portion of that on the Bakamla, or the Maritime Security Agency, that's in parliament right now as we speak, I think, to help give it more authority and more responsibility.
Well, this is where I think promises are long and have been said a lot.
Masing-masing undang-undang tersebut akan menjadi omnibus law.
And I'm saying this because the context in which the omnibus law on maritime security was proposed was the Natunas, because of the crisis that we had with China since like before Christmas.
Yeah, I want to get into that a bit later.
Until January. And one of the challenges of responding to China's incursions in our waters is that, who do we deploy? Because if it's exclusive economic zones, technically it's law enforcement. But then if they use Coast Guards, do we deploy the Navy? But China would say, well, that's not okay, because the Navy has more than law enforcement capability. So because of all this confusion, the omnibus law was proposed. I think, if I'm not mistaken, this was the proposal from the coordinating minister for legal, political, and security affairs.
Okay, so this is welcome. From the government side.
Yeah. Right, from the government side as a way to address this. But it's a promise because, one, Jokowi has other omnibus laws that are more of a priority. This is the investment omnibus. This is
labor.
The labor and all that. So because we've never done anything like an omnibus law before, I would say that the labor and investment would be much more of a priority. So we'll see if we can pass the pilot project of actually passing this first omnibus law on labor, for example, or employment. Then we might see a model in which we can actually push through a similar omnibus law for maritime security.
The Navy has their own rules. The Ministry of Transportation has their own rules. The Ministry of Maritime, they have their own rules. The military has their own rules. Immigration has their own rules. If it involves maritime, there are many regulations. We hope to simplify this. Coordinating Minister of Political, Legal, and Security Affairs, Mahfud MD.
The idea of the omnibus law on maritime security is to essentially synergize, or what they call harmonize, those existing competing laws I mentioned earlier about how different agencies have different authorities. In an extreme ideal best case scenario, at least for Bakamla's sake, is that every other agencies with the assets and authority over EEZ, for example, should be merged into Bakamla's assets and authority. So Bakamla should be the primary single Coast Guard, with the Navy occasionally providing backup as and when as necessary. But I think that's a pretty high bar. There's going to be pushbacks from the Fisheries Minister and all that. Last I heard from Paul Hukam, this was maybe in mid-January, they said that the earliest they can have a first draft of their version of an omnibus law on maritime security is probably around May or June, because it requires time to look at dozens of laws and regulations and all that. So this is why I'm not convinced that it's going to be passed this year, when you have other priorities, I think, to be passed. Because once you have a first draft, you got to have interagency meetings, you got to have a first reading with parliament and all that. So I think it's in the best case scenario, you'll have something of a hearing maybe sometime next year.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, I'm not so sure, because if you look at the actual list of legislative priorities, the maritime security law was not actually listed as omnibus. It is perceived as such because of that promise during the whole Natuna standoff, but it's not really yet.
And that whole standoff happened just really as the House session began for, mm-hmm. you know, for 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So the timing, I think, maybe had something to do with it as well.
Yep. A key pillar of President Joko Widodo administration's Grand National Development Plan is the CETOL program, which will serve as the backbone of his vision of Indonesia as a global maritime hub.
Jokowi's grand plan.
Another part of the GMF, I think, was creating sort of a CETOL toll lane, creating connectivity between main islands and outer islands in an effort to stimulate the economy and also improve the exchange of goods and services to these remote islands. But that has also fallen far short from expectations, has it?
Yeah, I think on the economic connectivity within Indonesia, I think there's improvements obviously in some ports in terms of their management and their ability to get goods out of ports quicker and more efficient and all that. But in terms of actually developing new ports and new capabilities across mm-hmm. Indonesia, which is the essence of that a maritime highway, if you will, I think that's maybe, if you believe the government's claim, it's roughly about 60 to 70%. But I think in actuality, when you ask businesses, I think they would say, yes, it's better, but it's not fundamentally better to the point of making businesses much more quicker and cheaper to transport goods from port to port across Indonesia. And I think this is where Jokowi's frustration with the bureaucracy, I think, is starting to show. If you remember at the beginning of his term, he wanted to cut the inefficiency at the bureaucratic level by cutting, I think, two echelons out the top leadership. But, you know, we've been talking about bureaucratic reform since forever because it matters for a lot of things, not just in terms of the maritime highway, but competitiveness, ease of doing business and all that. And I think, to be honest, yes, it has improved, but I wouldn't call it a complete success yet, especially when it comes to port safety and port development. I think that's still a ways off right now.
And then moving forward, Jokowi starts his second term, inaugurated in October last year.
Yang sangat kompetitif, kita harus terus mengembangkan cara-cara baru, nilai-nilai baru. Jangan sampai.
In his inauguration speech, one thing was very lacking was any mention of maritime. So it seems that this GMF, this Global Maritime Fulcrum, is basically on the back burner. He said in his inauguration speech instead talked about human capital, economic transformation, things like that. What's behind this change in stance? Before in 2014, he was all about maritime, at least in his first year or so, and then now his second term, basically no mention of it.
Well, I think he realizes that having big visions are sort of pointless in Indonesia if you don't change the bureaucracy and fix the infrastructure. So I think it makes sense that from his point of view, let the vision of the maritime fulcrum be in the background, maybe even in a very Javanese way, the philosophy, if you will. But when it comes to trying to get policy priorities straight and doing business on a day-to-day basis, I think he feels he needs to put more emphasis on fixing the bureaucracy, boosting investment and infrastructure, and making sure that he's preparing for the human capital side of things. So in his mind, the big agenda of the first term was infrastructure. The big agenda on the second term is human capital development.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else should be reoriented towards supporting that big vision. And, you know, if you look at it from outside of Indonesia, the GMF was always be seen as a potentially grand strategic geopolitical outlook type of thing, right? Because it has all the language of such a grand strategic outlook, that Indonesia is the fulcrum between two oceans, that we should be a force in the region and not just be the transit point across two oceans. So the language does give that impression. But I do think Jokowi's unwillingness to grasp the day-to-day details and nuances, foreign policy, defense, and geopolitical issues, I think he doesn't really see the value in keep on promoting mm-hmm. a strongly geopolitical outlook if he cannot fix mm-hmm. the basic stuff on the domestic and the bureaucratic stuff. So I think for me, his second term is more about I'm going to finish what I started, which is trying to build the infrastructure, making sure that when I leave, there's something left behind. Because if you ask people on the street, what did SBY left behind in terms of things that you can remember just on top of your head, which is hard to do when you don't look at buildings and monuments and infrastructure and all of those. So I think Jokowi's effort at legacy seeking, if you will, is not going to be on the maritime fulcrum and geopolitical stuff. It's going to be on the day-to-day nitty-gritty stuff of infrastructure and investment.
Yeah, there was some criticism of, you know, Jokowi just dropped this, you know, maritime policy, but in a way, maybe it is a good thing, knowing it can't be accomplished, focus on the steps before that, and then maybe get that, and then, you know, a future leader could work on that. So maybe it's a good thing that he dropped it, knowing it can't be accomplished anyway, at least in this next 5 years.
Well, this is the thing with Indonesian politics and bureaucracy. If you drop it, people don't remember. If people don't remember, people don't care. So one of the reasons why it seems shocking that Indonesia, as the largest archipelago state in the world, actually tries to come back to its root only in 2014. But in fact, if you look at the actual policies from Megawati to SBY, they did create some maritime policies. They established the maritime fisheries ministries. They had created a maritime a council. So there were maritime policies. It's not like there was no maritime policies whatsoever. There were maritime policies. But precisely because we don't remember, because there was no vision, there was no grand narrative that was sold to the public and became the overarching drive and energy across the bureaucracy, people simply forget. So it's fascinating to me that you had that narrative, you had that formula that would be a lot more remembered than your previous presidents could ever do.
Who actually were doing
right, exactly. Things, yeah. So it's fascinating that it's dropped from the narrative. So if people will remember Jokowi's first term as essentially about maritime, if it dies now in the second term, I don't think people will remember anymore. And to be fair, you're right that it's good that Jokowi focuses on the basic stuff. But my worry is that the focus on the basic stuff provides this insular worldview and very narrow, that everything else is subservient to that goal. Of course, you know, being somebody in government means you don't have one priority. You have 50 different mm-hmm, other mm-hmm. things you have to accomplish. And we get it, the dilemma of governing a country as big as Indonesia, as diverse as Indonesia, cannot be just about 50 different things. It could be 15,000, right?
All at the same time.
Right, yeah. But I think Jokowi's unwillingness to listen and to be engaged daily on the other stuff that he doesn't care about, I think has hurt him from time to time, whether with the electorate or within the bureaucracy itself. So I think Jokowi's obsession on a few narrow things is acceptable and completely understandable. But if that's all there is to it, then it's not sufficient.
I see. Interesting.
Now, we are at the peak of the demographic bonus, where the productive age is far more than the non-productive population. This is a major challenge. President Widodo.
And one of the focuses or priorities that you mentioned was improving human capital. And I think that's a major concern for Indonesia, as it's a very young demographic. You'll have a demographic bonus coming in several years from now, already starting maybe. And I think the concern is, where will the workforce be at that time, and will there be jobs? At the same time, manufacturing in Indonesia hasn't really taken off. Also, at the same time, you have automation, innovation, and more efficiencies coming. So I think that's a major concern, where it's coming soon, and you know, a lot of this workforce is going to be very young and very big, and you need to, you know, have them doing something.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think a key part of the problem facing that potential demographic shift down the line is the fact that the economy and the political side and the social side is all very much Java-centric. And I think Jokowi had the right idea when he wants to de-Javanize economic development and all that, make sure we also develop Borneo and the rest of the country beyond Java. But the problem isn't necessarily in the intent or the idea behind the vision, but this how you get it. If you rush a lot of the key vision, then you miss out on things like the bureaucracy, like unintended consequences that may cause conflict, for example. You know, just the same thing with trying to move the capital to East Kalimantan. The idea makes sense, intuitively speaking. Yeah, Jakarta is sinking. It makes sense. But is the solution really moving the capital there? Is the solution not improving governance in Jakarta? There are so many things that I wish could have been discussed a little bit more, especially with the public and not just within the halls of the bureaucracy. So I think, like in all matters, I think the vision that Jokowi has in mind is perfectly apt, given Indonesia's situation and trajectory. But how he implements that vision, I think, is where we'll see a lot of challenges.
Ini saya mohon izin untuk memindahkan ibu kota negara kita ke Pulau Kalimantan.
You just mentioned the new capital. Jokowi announced last year that the new capital would be located in. Is it Eastern Kalimantan?
It's in between Eastern and the South, yeah.
And it would, you know, change the center of gravity from Java to Kalimantan. What does that really mean symbolically? And what does it mean for Indonesian maritime security, even for the ethnic dynamic in Indonesia?
Well, there is a couple of different dimensions to that shift, right? From a military standpoint, Indonesia for the first time would not have a military center of gravity in Java, which is going to be in Kalimantan, because the shift of the capital would be followed by the creation of new military units and commands and naval bases and an air force bases across Kalimantan, not to mention the deployment of potentially simple missile defense and all that, because we have a border with Malaysia and others. So I think this is unprecedented. I don't think the Indonesian military itself has prepared all of the details or even the concept of how we're going to create a new center of gravity in Kalimantan.
Were they even consulted at the time?
Oh, they were. They were consulted. They drafted a brief proposal of what would happen and what is required. If it's true that they have to be in Kalimantan, they've planned out a few items, you know, what kind of bases do they need, how many people do they need, how much it costs and all that. And the rough estimation before it was announced, there's new revisions after it was announced, but before it was announced, I think the last revision that I saw, the cost like almost $10 billion. This is to bring in new fighter jets, new deep ports, new special army command for the new capital and all that, and shifting between 15 to 25,000 new troops across Kalimantan. Because it's not just the capital area alone that you have to develop. You have to develop the rest of Kalimantan. So that's about $10 billion more or less, which means every plan that we have on the military side to buy new equipment, to engage in long-term planning, will all fall by the wayside, because this will reshift every resources that we have to Kalimantan. And this is not even including, we're not really sure the extent to which we've consulted the Malaysians, the Bruneians, and even the Philippines, because we are technically going to be a lot closer to a porous tri-border area, bit up to the north, right? And it's also placing us, I mean, the new capital, in the heart of a strategic ceiling of communications between the Pacific Oceans around the Philippines, all the way down to the eastern part of Indonesia, which is a pretty busy sea lane. So it's not clear to me how far ahead we've thought about all of this. On the economic side, I think right now there's a concern from civil society groups that right now a lot of the land and the forests around the area have already been bought or being controlled by key conglomerates, which means a lot of this could be just a big payout for them before Jokowi ends his term, but then we're not really sure how it's going to be built. Mm-hmm. And the timeline, to be honest, is extremely quick, because now you have to move the bureaucracy.
Unreasonable. Yeah.
I cannot imagine moving everything by 2024. I think if we're really, really extremely quick, we'll be lucky if we have a few buildings up and running by 2024. And this is not even talking about the tons of problems that will come when you don't have the funding for it. You have to rely on public-private partnership. When you rely on public-private partnership, you have to open it up to foreign investment. How sure are we that we want to let the Chinese build our buildings for the government? The East Timorese seems to be okay with building its Ministry of Defense from the Chinese, but I'm not sure that's the way to go.
I haven't heard anyone talk about that yet. Interesting.
Yeah, so it's again, the big vision makes perfect sense, but I just don't think a lot of the nitty-gritty details have been worked out and discussed in detail.
From a military point of view, I know that the reason for moving the capital is, one is Jakarta's overcrowded, flood-prone, many other things. But from a maritime or military perspective, does it make sense? Or is it better to have the headquarters and main bases in Java?
Well, I think when it comes to the Navy, because we're talking about the Navy here and not necessarily a maritime law enforcement, because maritime law enforcement, I think it would make sense to have a lot of the assets and the facilities around the outer islands part across Indonesia and not just centralized within one or two commands, which is a different way of operating when you're the Navy. With the Navy, it depends on what kind of assets you want, because certain warships or submarines cannot dock in some ports. You have to create deep sea ports and all that. Mm-hmm. And the only deep sea port that we're now using for the Navy is actually in Sulawesi. So it's still within distance to the capital, but it's not that close either. So geographically speaking, it shouldn't matter much on the maritime side if we move the center of gravity from Java to Kalimantan, in that I think the idea is to allow to control the sea lanes on the north and the south between Sulawesi and Kalimantan. There's a big swath of water there that requires control from the Navy. And that is something that I think, as far as planning goes, is about assets rather than a command and control. So the naval base could be in Surabaya, that's fine. But the home base of some of the most advanced assets have to be a bit closer to the capital. But the problem is, we're not at a stage in military technology where it's all about how close you should be to the main political center, because we have cyber, we have missile defense and all that, that requires investment in technology and not more people. But with the military, the solution is to have more people and not more technology. So this is a bit tricky because, as you mentioned earlier, the army still dominates defense planning. But as far as I can see, I think Prabowo, as defense minister, I think in his first few months in office, I think he really is trying to reevaluate the military procurement list and priorities and all that. So I think what is important is the army-to-army engagement, I think, with Malaysia, with Brunei and the Philippines, and improve maritime law enforcement coordination for the surrounding waters. I think the Navy can stay as is, but I think the maritime law enforcement and the army-to-army engagement needs to be increased.
Mm-hmm. And so that would mean more cooperation along the tri-border area with Malaysia and Philippines?
Yep. That's definitely the case. And the Army likes to make the case that they're still worried about the five power defense arrangements.
You mentioned that very recently.
This is the arrangement between Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia, and Singapore, and the UK. It was created under very different circumstances. This was created in the 60s when Indonesia was seen as an expansionist power because of its challenge against Malaysia's creation. But I don't think we have developed sufficient engagement with the FPDA as a framework.
FDPDA?
FPDA. This is the five power defense arrangements. So if Indonesia doesn't have a regular consultation and engagement with FPDA, I think it might create potential acrimony or even distrust somewhere down the line, especially if we will effectively militarize the entire island of Kalimantan within the next 5-10 years. Mm-hmm. You don't want to step on the wrong toes, or they feel we're becoming expansionist again, or vice versa, that we are still feeling being contained, if you will, by these five power defense arrangements. And nobody wins if you have more acrimony between us and Malaysia and Singapore and Australia. So moving the capital isn't just about having new buildings and moving troops and buying weaponry, but it's about engagement with your neighbors as well. And I'm not sure this is something we've thought through very well.
Mm-hmm. And is there any chance Jokowi ends his second term in 2024 under the current law? At least he's not allowed to run for a third term.
Mm.
Is there a chance that this whole plan for the capital may not happen? Or could it be canceled after his term?
It depends on how far the process goes when he ends, right? If there is a law passed within the next 1 or 2 years directing the government to move the capital, if the National Capital Management Agency is created or about to be created, and then we've sunk in sufficient funds into the process, at least the land is clear and maybe 1 or 2 buildings, I think it's going to continue. But it's probably going to continue along the lines like South Korea did, which is slow and gradual and not all in one swoop. I think that's a best case scenario. So the best case scenario for me isn't the entire capital literally moving by the end of 2024, but the initial groundwork and the cost and the bureaucracy and the legal basis are all set up at the end of 2024 so that if the next government decides to slow down that progress for whatever reason, at least it's there.
Yeah.
But I'm not entirely optimistic right now, just because I think the priorities of the current government is essentially how do we get more money for our budget? And that's a main priority. And this is why you see a push from the tax ministry. Yeah. You see, like, in Christmas, they start doing raids on expensive cars across Jakarta, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There's a genuine need, I think, within the government. How do we get more money, period? And I think this is where the priorities for the omnibus law on employment, on investment is being pushed ahead. So if you push these laws ahead and your drive to increase the tax base and all that is technically the first business of the day, then what happens with all the political wrangling and negotiations over the new bill for the capital?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not super optimistic. And if the last term of DPR is any indication, it's going to be extremely slow.
Yeah, very low performance.
Yeah. Or they make it worse and they pass things the last 2 weeks before their term is up.
Yeah.
I hope that doesn't happen, but I don't know. I'm very pessimistic when it comes to DPR.
Yeah, to move the capital, you know, many people think the president decided, so it's going to happen. But there's a whole list of regulations, laws that have to be changed. There's even laws in the special autonomy region of Jakarta.
Mm.
So there's a whole list of things that need to be done even to start thinking about it. So I think a lot of people forget that.
China Coast Guard, 5302. This is Indonesian Coast Guard calling you over. You are in Indonesian waters.
No. I protest my business trip.
China Coast Guard, Indonesian Coast Guard calling.
This is China Coast Guard 5302. China has an indisputable sovereignty over the island in South China Sea and the adjacent waters, and enjoys sovereign rights.
I order you, sir, to go away.
My fishing boat now is...
But I just want to move to the Natuna Sea. You brought up earlier the Exclusive Economic Zone, or the EEZ, which is near Riau and reaches very far north towards the South China Sea, in borders two territorial waters, Malaysia and Vietnam. And you know, when you look at the so-called 9-dash line, which is a vaguely located demarcation line used by China for their claims of the South China Sea, if you look at the 9 dashes, you see sort of one that's missing right at the bottom. It seems like it should be a 10-dash line, and the 10th should be right over or covering the Natuna Sea. Indonesia doesn't have any disputes, territorial disputes right now with China, unlike some of its neighbors, but it has had issues with Chinese fishing vessels exploiting fisheries in the Natuna Sea and in Indonesian waters. In addition to that, you have some large gas deposits, Natuna D Alpha Block, for example, in that area. And we see Chinese encroachment into territorial waters of Indonesia. Is there bound to be a territorial dispute sometime between China and Indonesia? Or will China just keep pushing the threshold as far as it can, meaning coming into the waters, being escorted, fishing boats being escorted by the Chinese Coast Guard? Will they just keep doing that? Or is there a bigger concern coming in the near future?
So for me, I'm of a slightly different view about why and how China is doing things with us on the Natunas. I think the resource element is overblown for a couple of reasons. One, China's pushback against Vietnam or Malaysia or Philippines engaging in hydrocarbon resources, in terms of exploiting the hydrocarbon resources, makes sense from a dispute standpoint, because they actually do have overlapping disputes on those areas, unlike with us. But even then, on those areas that they challenge in terms of the ability of the other claimants to use those resources, China hasn't exactly been enjoying those resources, right? So yes, are there values to the South China Sea in general in terms of hydrocarbon? Absolutely. Fisheries? Absolutely. The same thing with Indonesia. But I do think, unlike with the other claimants, China's challenge and incursions in our waters isn't designed to capture or occupy the hydrocarbon resources themselves, or occupy one of the island features around Indonesia's waters. I think the challenge is geostrategic in nature, in that it is about its larger claims. And I'll tell you why. Because if you actually look at the resources or the fisheries that China stole, and I'm using steal here deliberately, because it is Indonesia's exclusive economic rights, the amount of resources that China stole, we don't have the exact figures, but as far as I can understand it from the people on the ground, the maritime law enforcement people, the value is actually not that high, because around those choppy, difficult waters in the Natunas, they're not high value fishes. They're fisheries that will be used for cattle feed and all that. So it's not necessarily high value like clams and expensive fishes that you would get in the Philippines or even Vietnam and Malaysia. So around the slice of that potential overlap, the value is actually not that high. So why does China keep on doing it if the value is not that high? I think it's important because Indonesia remains a non-claimant. And by non-claimant, as in Indonesia does not stake a claim in the disputed parts of the South China Sea. In this particular case, more geographically speaking, it's within the Spratly Islands. So we don't stake a claim. But as you mentioned earlier, there is a potential overlap between Indonesia's EEZ with China's claim. The problem is that we don't know what those claims are. Every time we ask the Chinese, if you say that there is an overlapping rights, can you please tell us where the coordinates are and what are the international legal basis for you to claim those coordinates? We've never given any clear answer. So when we say that there is no dispute, it's because there isn't one in terms of exclusive economic zones. Per UNCLOS, we have one with Vietnam and Malaysia, as you mentioned earlier. But when it comes to the Chinese, they don't have one. So it's like you try to steal a car and then you claim, well, for a win-win solution, how about we split the deed to the car? Well, no, the deed is under my name, and my name is given by UNCLOS, right? So it makes no sense for us to acknowledge that there's a dispute when you stole the car that's legally and rightfully mine, and you say the win-win solution is how about we split the deed? Yeah. That makes no sense. So from that standpoint, there is no dispute. Now, whether or not China keeps on incursing into our waters, we see that as a law enforcement problem. Yes, we will keep on trying to enforce our rights within the EZ. In Susi's terms, we would detain and occasionally blow up the ship. So that part doesn't change the fact that our EEZ is our EEZ, and the sovereign rights as granted per UNCLOS remains ours. Now, the issue is whether or not China can inadvertently get us to acknowledge that they have rights as well. Because from the foreign ministry, that's quick, simple, and easy. There is no negotiation. There is no conversation that involves discussions about overlapping maritime rights. China can use 50 different new terms, you know, jurisdiction over relevant waters, historic fishing grounds, and all that. UNCLOS only recognizes historic fishing rights as granted by both countries in dispute. And we recognize those rights with Malaysia and Vietnam as much as Australia recognizes Indonesia's traditional fishing rights in parts of their water. So historic fishing rights is there. But anyway, going back to the point about what's next, the idea is that if we somehow, outside of the foreign ministry, whether it's the fisheries minister or some other member of the political elite, inadvertently say, oh yeah, we don't want conflict, we can just discuss things with the Chinese peacefully, that could be seen as implicitly acknowledging that they have a right to begin with. And this is where it's dangerous, because if we inadvertently acknowledge China's rights, that means the only way that is legally possible is if we accept that China can draw a 200 nautical mile line from one of its occupied features or some sort of artificial islands that's part of the dispute at Spratly's. Which means if that happens, the claimants, the other non-Chinese claimants, all of their claims will be undermined, and we will effectively become a part of the dispute, and China will effectively become a party to our efforts to finalize our maritime delimitation negotiation with Vietnam and Malaysia. So the danger, I think, lies in that inadvertent admission of China's rights. And that's why China is engaging in what scholars call salami slicing. They provide incursions, small scale enough that it's not seen as an outright act of aggression or war. But over time, as they build the artificial islands, as they deploy military assets, these small steps, seemingly minor, annoying even, they become a huge accumulated strategic advantage. And when the time happens, and China has time, they've been waiting on this for decades. They're not in a rush. The other claimants are in a rush, you know. Philippines are in the midst of an energy crisis, so they need to develop the resources. So if we inadvertently acknowledge their rights, if it's bound to happen somewhere on the line, I think that's the end game for us, if we implicitly acknowledge that right. So I think these incursions are meant to test our resolve on a regular basis.
So it's not about fisheries. It's not about fishing boats. It's about making these routine excursions for a bigger goal.
The fisheries themselves as such, I don't think is the goal. I think the fisheries themselves is merely a tool in their path to eventually get us to implicitly acknowledge that wider claim.
That's interesting, because I haven't seen or heard many people talking about that. But the Indonesian government is aware of this?
The foreign ministry is certainly aware of it. And this is, I think, the bigger problem with Indonesia's response on China is that who's responding? And do we have a collective system in which actors from different agencies improve their communication, but also provide options in a centralized manner? We don't have a National Security Council type like the US. So when it comes to the maritime stuff, do we go to the coordinating minister for maritime affairs, which is technically more investment, or do we go to the one that's Paul Hukam, that's more legal and political? But even then, I think the coordinating ministry is essentially just that. It coordinates. It doesn't have the authority to legally order the other ministers to do X, Y, and Z. That rests within the president. So in the absence of a National Security Council under the president, information, policies, and options to deal with China is fragmented, which means each bureaucracy has its own idea. The fisheries minister has its own idea. The foreign minister has her own idea. Defense minister has his own idea. So this is what it's tricky, because they only get together under some crisis. What happens on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah.
And I think this is where, as long as our response is not formulated strategically and coherently, our ability to counter China's strategy is going to be limited and at best not sustainable.
Be sure to follow Evan Laksmana's Twitter feed to learn more of his insights and analysis at Evan Laksmana. Executive producer for this episode is me, Sean. Producer is Tanita. Research done by Veronica. Sound engineering by Risky. And visual design by our newest team member, Daniel. Email us your comments and feedback to info@indonesiaindepth.com. You can also follow us on our socials, Twitter @IndoInDepth, Instagram @IndonesiaInDepth, or at our website, IndonesiaInDepth.com. Thank you for listening.